This is part two of our live event, Science Cafe. The topic was fire. If you're just joining us, go back and check out part one.
Cool. that's a good answer, man. Hey,
that's all you have to say, Ryan. I'm just going to sit down.
See you guys. my question's about the retardant. I've always been curious, how is that affect local ecology or wherever we're placing it? And then also, how does it affect water systems, if it does? Because I had no idea what retardant's made out of, so I've been curious about that.
Well, I'll talk a little bit, and then I'll let these guys talk about how it affects the environment. So there is plans to how that stuff is put down. So we don't just arbitrarily say, I want a line here and I want a line there, and we don't care what's underneath it. So when we go into fight fires, there's a planning team that goes in to do this, and that includes folks that are in there to look after our natural resources. They're a big part of that input, and they're a big part of approving that plan. And part of that is if we put retardant down here, what is it going to affect? And most of the time that's going to be waterways. And because I'll be honest with you, retardant is not good for aquatic life. It's not good for fish, and it's not good for water. So generally speaking, unless it was an extreme life-saving action of people, then they're going to keep it out of the waterways. That's a big no-no, that we don't drop on waterways. So that's kind of where it lays. It does put that red stripe down for a long, long time. But as far as I know from what retardant is made out of, it's biodegradable. It will soak in, but I'll let them talk about maybe the long-term effects.
Yeah, and I don't know much about the actual composition of fire retardant. What I do know, in addition to the waterways, I think they are really cautious about using it in like designated wilderness areas as well. And so I know that there are, for sure, certain locations that they're very reluctant to use retardant if they're sensitive ecosystems.
I know it sticks on you for a very long time, and it doesn't come out of clothes, and somehow it makes it down into your ears, like way deep. I don't know how that happens. It just has a magnet. So
yeah, all I know is if we got back to the station and we had retardant on our trucks, Chief would skin our hides. Yeah. We were in big trouble. Yeah. Also, this is the only other thing I know about retardant. If a VLAD accidentally does a drop on a hotshot crew, you will hear a chorus of colorful language extend for quite a few minutes. They don't like that.
That's very true.
So as a chemist, I had to look up what fire retardant was. And it's actually an ammonium phosphate, similar to fertilizer. And apparently when it burns or when it chars in the fire, it generates CO2 and water, and that basically removes oxygen to basically stop the fire from burning.
So in my family works in wildland fire, and we had a fire that came through our the sloughs in Moab, and we were looking around in the aftermath probably a good 3 weeks later, and I just saw a pile that was smoldering, kicked it for fun, and it sparked right back up. And I was just wondering if you guys knew a little bit more about the science behind that and like the conditions that would cause that so many days after when it had been declared out.
So when you put a fire out, there's a lot of steps, but one is to establish that perimeter. And once we get a perimeter established, we have the area called the black. And the black will hold fire in different stages, whether it's smoldering or actual flame, for a long time. I mean, there's fires that'll be going almost all summer long with just stuff burning inside of the black. And that's just something that when you have these larger fires, there's no way to put water on everything that is on fire in there. So sometimes you just got to watch it and let it go out. But having said that, there's also incidences where, especially up in forested areas where you have a lot of roots that go deep and roots that are rotten, maybe, they've had fires that have lasted through the winter. that have burned through those root systems and then popped up the next year when it got warm enough. And so I don't know really how to answer your question, but fire's a survivor, and as long as it will have enough oxygen and enough fuel and enough uninterrupted reaction time, it'll burn for however long it has that. And sometimes that's just a matter of being a coal to versus being an open free burning flame. So they'll burn for a long time. I mean, that fire in 2020, there was hot spots out there for months and months afterwards.
I think a lot of it can also depend on the vegetation type that's burning. Mm-hmm. You know, some, I think like oak is notorious for burning like really hot and really slow. And so, you know, I think that maybe initially it could be thought that it's out and then it might keep smoldering and sort of come back. So I think that has quite a bit to do with it as well.
You know, you mentioned that you kicked it, and that tells me right there that, you know, you're below the surface where it's probably insulated and that heat is still being trapped. It's got the fuel. If you just limit the oxygen a little bit, you know, you can slow the reaction, but it'll still go. I've been on a fire where there's been, they call it duff. I'm sure there's more scientific terms for it, but just an accumulation of pine needles where at the surface, it was undisturbed. It didn't look like anything, but we started packing down, and within 6 or 7 inches below the surface, it was burning. It was burning under, it had burned underneath and was underburning, and it was, could have popped up anywhere.
So people have like famously started fires, but so many fires are natural. Is that different year by year? Is it trending one way or another? Are natural or artificial, not artificial, they're all real, but are human caused fires worse on average, or is there just no pattern whatsoever?
It kind of depends year to year. I know that in after the pandemic started, we had a lot more people out and about, and we were impacted pretty heavily in our end of the state. We attracted a lot of people that decided they were gonna sell or rent their house out and get an RV and go see the world. And they ended up here for a good portion of that time. I mean, the comments I got were like, I can work from my trailer as long as I got Wi-Fi. They loaded up the kids can go to school. They weren't going into work, they were working from home, so they just decided to go see the world. And so that impacted how many people we had in our area. And we saw this in a lot of different ways. Search and rescue, we saw an uptick. And I think that contributed some to our fires. However, having that influx of people and the conditions that we had, we also put in fire restrictions earlier and a little bit stronger. So it kind of reduced some of those fires that normally would have been caused by people just obeying the rules, maybe not putting out their campfire as good as they could have, but it eliminated the fires that were outside of undeveloped camp areas and undeveloped places. And then further on, it was no fires at all. So it was kind of a double-edged thing. We kind of upped our ante on the enforcement of where fires were at, but it also, we had the influx of people. So I think we saw a little bit of an increase with that. But other years, we'll see a drop. We'll see a drop in both. I mean, there's some years we've been ready to fight fire and ready for a big season, and it just never came. The storms were just right. You know, they had the lightning, but they also had water with them. So, you know, we had a lot of single tree fires that didn't go anywhere. And then other years that, you know, we got hounded with dry lightning. So I don't know. I'd have to look into that pattern. You know, we get a report, and to be honest with you, it's something I look at, and we get it, and then I kind of put it in the back of my mind, but I'd like to look at that.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. So the two large fires that burned in the reserve in 2020, they were both human-caused. One was started by teenagers playing with fireworks along the Cottonwood Springs Road. The other one was started along I-15, and kind of a fluke, it was started from a tire blowout. And so I guess maybe the rim lit a spark or something like that, and off it went. It was really dry. Generally speaking, like in my world of like habitat management, there is definitely a concern of just as we get more and more people in this community, just statistically, it's more and more likely that you're gonna have more idiots out there playing with fireworks, doing whatever, you know, flicking a cigarette butt out the window, whatever it might be. And so I think there is a worry that maybe as just we get more and more people in our community, we're gonna have, you know, just more likely to get larger fires. And then as we have more, you know, there's a concern with roads, allowing access into certain areas, potentially also could lead to additional fires just because humans are able to be there, whereas they maybe couldn't, you know, weren't able to be there in the past. So anyway, all of those things I think play a role. And it'll just be interesting to see how that trends in the future for sure.
So, Greg, this might be a question for you, but if you go up towards past Alston Point and kind of up on the Kaiparowitz, there's a Great Smoky Road, Great Smoky Mountain Road. And then if you go up towards Hanksville, there's some other smoky mountain areas, and they're basically burning coal seams. So can you explain what the coal seam is and why those lead to fires that have been going on for centuries?
So yeah, so coal is an accumulation of plant material, okay? But it's in a specific environment. Think like the Everglades, something swampy, something where there's an accumulation of water, and the water is oxygen poor. And so what happens is all of this biomass ends up dying and accumulating, and because of the anoxic or the low oxygen environment, it doesn't break down. And so you get this accumulation, and then over geologic time, it's, you know, compressed and heated, and eventually the carbon molecules in that plant life start converting into these really long chain hydrocarbon ligands and things like that. And so you end up producing this, that's how you get coal. And then once that gets ignited, there is the potential for that sort of thing. I want to say some of them have been burning for decades, right? Yeah. 50, 60 years or something stupid. Again, it's the same thing I was talking about, access. Like, we just can't access that fire. There's no way to get to it. You know, fairly low oxygen, but you've got the fuel, and you've got, it's sandwiched between rocks, and so it stays nice and insulated, and it could just go. Luckily, it doesn't hurt too many people, but, yeah.
So I read an article recently that after the Turkey Farm Road fire, there was an active effort to reseed the area and try to restore it, and I'm just kind of wondering what determines what areas are going to see that sort of active restoration, whereas other areas they would just kind of let return to normal over time. Like, how do you decide which ones you actively restore versus which ones you just kind of let go?
So I can speak a little bit about that. I don't know everything that went into the decision of like, okay, these are the areas we're going to seed. These are the areas we're gonna let come back naturally. That was an effort led by the DWR, Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, those aerial seeding efforts. I can say that, you know, certain vegetation communities that we're seeing out there are naturally coming back a lot better on their own compared to others. And so it may well be the case that they're seeding the areas that don't appear to be coming back as well. One example, like there's an area that burned through like a bunch of sand sagebrush and different types of bunch grasses, and that stuff actually has already come back pretty well in like really sandy soils. And so some of those native species are just coming back really well. Other stuff like creosote bush tends not to come back as well. And so it is very possible that they're focused more on those locations. But I'm not 100% sure about that. I know that, you know, most of those efforts that you were reading about, I believe were being done on state lands. And then I think the BLM has another strategy for how they're planning on doing some restoration as well. But yeah, that seems to make that seems to be the most logical approach for me, but I just don't know for certain how they're doing it.
And we'd be lying if we didn't say there was some politics involved. So when you're talking about BLM versus county versus Forest Service, you know,
or even BIA,
you know, they all have their agenda, and not faulting them for them, but you know, that's, they get their different fundings from different sources, and so they, some have the ability to do that and some people don't. One of the things that we do look at too when reseeding on a limited scope is the landslide threat to different areas. If we can get the vegetation back on those those hillsides and stuff, we can reduce that landslide potential. It's kind of it's a crapshoot, just because, you know, you're going to put seed down on there and you don't know if the spring is going to come and send you a lot of water or a lot of runoff, and then you've washed down all your seeding. But you know, you kind of just hope and you try to plan. But
yeah, and another thing that I just thought of, I know some of the restoration efforts going on out there are kind of strategic in areas that water is more likely to accumulate, like at the base of like a slope or along a wash, areas that are just more likely to get water and hopefully come back on their own, as opposed to just totally exposed out in the open dry areas. And then the idea is that hopefully in time, if you can establish these little islands of vegetation, maybe over the course of many, many decades, the seeds that those plants produce can be dispersed and start, you know, seeding on their own. And so a lot of these efforts that are going on right now have started with like strategic, okay, we're gonna do this because we feel like this area has the best chance of propagation. And then, which is a good approach, especially when you can't do things on like a huge landscape level. So that's another approach that's being used.
You answered my question a little bit with your last answer, but what efforts are being taken to prevent that erosion and runoff that do put communities at risk for landslides? Just what techniques are being used to prevent landslides, specifically to protect communities post-fire?
So there are a number of mitigation techniques. Revegetation has got to be one of the biggest and the most effective, for pretty obvious reasons. But as far as I know, post-fire, that's kind of it. And then identifying those regions that are of greatest risk, and then letting the public know that. So just getting that word out. Could you guys think of
that? That's really, I mean, we'll look at areas that, and the problem is that a lot of times when we start addressing that problem is when we actually know about that problem. So when we have these floods that come down, we don't know what's going to landslide and what's not. So sometimes it's a reaction. But we try to look at that, and if we suspect something like that's going to happen, really the protection that we have is at the bottom. So either to divert the flow down to the right spots, or divert the flow at the very bottom with stuff like riprap and those kind of things. But a lot of times it's, you don't know it's going to be a problem until it's a problem. It's really hard to tell.
And that's one of those issues that you can just keep throwing money at and still not predict the problem.
So other question is, what technologies are involved in firefighting now? Like, do you have satellites, drones? What kind of stuff's going on?
There's all kinds of technologies. There's use of drones, like you said, for identifying and mapping fires to, in some instances, even starting backfires. They can use drones for that kind of thing. There's a ton of GPS work going on with mapping the fire for identifying heat in a fire. Usually on a fire of any size, they'll do a mapping flight, which is usually at night, and they will take heat signatures off the fire, kind of tell them where the hot spots are kicking up and where they might be headed to. So that kind of technology is there. Obviously radios and things like that have come a long way versus what we used to use way back when. We had the tin cans and the strings between them. It just didn't work very well. So the new radios and stuff that we have to the fire equipment that we use. The brush trucks and stuff are totally different than they used to be as far as they're able to access to get into areas, how they drive, how the pumps work, the materials that we use, such as foam and the ratio of that to water and how that's introduced into the water. There's a ton of technology that goes into it, and it happens all the time. Back at the base camp, there is all kinds of information that's being fed into the base camp that are being used by rehabilitation groups, by planning, by situation awareness, by resource leaders. It's a huge amount of technology. You think that you're out there in the middle of nowhere, and you actually have all this technology that's being influenced.
I can remember the first wildfire I was deployed to, and there was they always set up these big tents, right? And about as big as this bay, but not quite as deep. I remember I walked into the wrong one, and there were all these computers set up and all these GIS specialists, like, just click, 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 just going at it. And the nerd inside of me just woke up, and I was like, what are you guys doing? What databases are we using here? Like, where are you getting your data? And, you know, it was just so cool to me, because here we were in the middle of nowhere, you know, still using basic techniques of, you know, dig a trench and put water on the hot stuff. And then in the background, you've got all this other stuff that's going on. It just made it even that much cooler to me. It was really, really cool.
So before we go to the next question, related to your question, I thought of something that I heard of, and I wanted to ask these guys next to me about it. Traditionally, like, some areas have hired like a fire lookout, like up on top of a peak somewhere. There's a little cabin where you have actually somebody stationed that looks for smoke, you know, calls stuff in to dispatch or whatever. A couple of years ago, I heard something about how there's some new technology that can just automatically detect smoke and send like a signal out without actually a human needing to be there to report it. I was wondering if these guys next to me have heard of anything like that.
I hope not, because that fire lookout is my dream job. So I want it still there. You know,
we don't want to make those cool jobs obsolete, right? We just change the subject.
And they actually still use those. There's still people out there doing that job. And but I have heard of that. I don't think it's a widespread technology. I don't think it's completely proven. But I know it's out there. I've heard the same thing. So. But I can't tell you much about it.
All right, so I think we're going to wrap it up. I want to thank you all for joining us. I want to thank Jeff Smith, who's been coordinating our podcast. If you're unfamiliar with our podcasts, go to sciencecafe.dixie.edu. Brady Iverson is our student intern, who also has been helping with the podcast and helped set up all the recording and the podcasting that we're setting up here. Aaron O'Brien and myself have helped just kind of give Jeff and Brady ideas and let them run with it. And thanks Zion Brewery for letting us host our event here tonight. And then finally, thank Greg, Mike, and Jason for their time and interesting thoughts and experiences with fire. So thank you all.